You're listening to Aero News. I'm Pete Combs. Finally, in this podcast, we bring you a lively presentation from the Theater in the Woods featuring legendary test pilot Scott Crossfield and the world's first commercial astronaut, Scaled Composites' Mike Melville.
I thank you all very, very much. I didn't know anybody was out there, and I was wondering where all that noise came from. Those lights don't let you see anybody, so if you don't think I'm talking to you personally, I am. I've been admonished that I have to behave myself tonight. And isn't this other one working?
No.
Oh. Is it on?
I hope so.
Anybody hear me? All right. This is kind of casual, isn't it? I have to be politically correct, and the whole program is wrong. It said Scott Crossfield and Mike Melville. It's Mike Melville and Scott Crossfield tonight. This is his day. And this morning, I decided, what do I do in a situation like this with all you strange people and your airplane inclinations? I mused a little, and my mind wandered over these thoughts. George Bernard Shaw, I think it was, once said, comparisons are odious. However, this mission tonight, that's exactly what it is. Then and now, they want. Then was post-World War II, when we had an aero technology explosion that was born of the invention of new power plants, jet and rockets, and the challenge of the ignorance we had of trans and supersonic flight with no viable wind tunnels to study them. Now is a new era of an aerotechnical explosion born of new materials and comprehensive understanding of the aerodynamics of supersonic flight and hardly any need for wind tunnels. Then was Ezra Kotcher and Larry Bell, and they dared to disagree with the expert academic clique and created the research airplane program to very successfully tackle the sound barrier and the temperature barriers. Now is when Bert Rutan, born to deviate from the classical, successfully clashed with cliche engineering and reestablished the Wright brother heritage of mind over tradition. Then was when the X-15 and I were at a Mexican standoff. It was going to do me in, and I was going to break that brook. I won after two airborne fires, one airborne explosion, one ground explosion, one broken airplane landing, one perilous landing with exciting control characteristics, and marvelous arguments for how we were going to get the tools to go into space. In 199 flights, not counting a very short one I made that they wouldn't count, the X-15 paved the road into dignified orbital flight. Now, a 60-ish, mild manner, one hell of an aviator, Mike Melville, in a sea-level cockpit, no pressure suit, wearing tennis shoes, and juggling floating M&Ms. Breaks the X-15 altitude record. Way overdue, I may say, to be broken, pretending to be laid back, nonchalant, and in an ingenious creation, the epitome of EAA mentality by Bert Rutan. I make these comments in overwhelming admiration for every facet of the Spaceship One single-minded development. To return to our thesis, then, and to say the odious comparison is beyond the pale, I refer to one example, to boundary layer, and that is to the boundary layer temperatures of 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit in spaceship one. And there's something over 4,000 feet in the X-15. The comparison of the airplanes is odious because they had completely different missions. The only thing common was they went for altitude. But both aircraft met their specifications beautifully. Now here is the man of the hour, Mike Melville, test pilot extraordinaire of the historic Spaceship One. Mike, tell us how it's done, please.
Thank you. Wow. There you go, I can see. Thank you very much, guys. Yeah, that's an amazing welcome. Gee whiz, and it's raining, too. Thanks for coming this evening. Really appreciate that. Did anybody see see us arriving? Yeah, I just got chastised for landing downwind. And I was pretty shocked because I thought I was landing upwind, but this shows you when you get older, you might miss a few things, like which way the wind's blowing. But it was okay. And we had Bert in the spaceship, his first ride, and he finally realized just how it felt to be there for an hour during the climb to get up there and feel nervous about, I wonder if I'm coming back from this one. You know, those kind of things would flash through your mind because what we were doing was halfway insane anyway. You know, we were going to light this rocket motor and try to go out of the atmosphere on a little airplane that never even been in a wind tunnel. So it was exciting. I heard some of Scott's stuff. Scott and I have done things before together, and he is my hero. He always has been. I just finished his book, Always Another Dawn, and it was fabulous, Scott, fabulous. Yeah, you know what we did was somewhat similar to what Scotty's team were trying to do. The main difference was speed. Altitudes were similar. G-forces going up and coming down were similar. But the difficulty of flying an X-15 into the atmosphere compared to flying a Spaceship One into the atmosphere, the difficulty was orders of magnitude more so. We had a system that Bert invented, the feather, that allowed a completely carefree reentry. The pilot could lean back, put his hands behind his head, take his feet off the pedals, and wait till he was back to the airport almost, and didn't have to do anything. These guys had to steer it with extreme precision to come back in safely. So what they did was much more difficult back then. But for the day, though, that must have been one heck of a vehicle. And how did you feel, Scott, when you dropped off the first time on your glide flight before you lit the motor? Were you nervous at all?
I was pretty busy and wasn't time for psychological evaluation.
You were busy? Well, I think I know what you felt like. You know, I think the scariest flight that I did was the first flight, dropping off from the bottom of the White Knight and wondering if it was going to fly. You know, Bert stuck his head in the cabin and said, "Don't worry about it, Mike, it's going to fly fine." And you know, having done a number of first flights for Bert, that's what he says every time. But, you know, he's always been right so far. You know, not having the benefit of a wind tunnel test of any kind, we just had Bert saying that looks about right, and a little bit of CFD, I don't know what that is, but these Boffin guys do that sort of work. Jim Tai is the guy that did a lot of our supersonic aerodynamics, and he did a good job on that. I think even Bert would agree with that. And it was a very, very exciting time to drop off. Dropped off, grabbed a hold of the stick, and wow, look at that, it actually flies. You know, that was kind of a cool thing. Did you get that sort of a sense when you dropped off that you had to get the nose down, get a little speed, and because you didn't have a rocket motor to accelerate yourself?
I don't know, Mike. You're asking me questions I can't answer.
You can't answer that?
I wasn't doing any psychological, emotional evaluation at the time. I was busy flying an airplane. I don't know what you were doing.
Well, that's great. I was pretty scared. But, you know, once I realized it was flying, it was great. I had a lot of fun, rolled the airplane, flew it all around the place, and came back in and made a decent landing, and so it was a great day for us.
In spite of my wisecracks, you did a remarkably beautiful job.
Thank you. The neat thing was that Scotty came out and watched us fly. It was wonderful to have him come out there and support us like that. I had tears in my eyes when I looked over and saw you looking over the fence there. I thought, wow, you come out here just to watch me fly that thing. That is cool. That's the real thing right there. You're the man, Scott. Okay, so I got some stuff on a TV. Are you seeing that up there?
Yeah.
Oh, look at that. Wow, what a high-tech place this is. What's this, though? Uh-oh, it went away. What happened to it? Okay, I got a little slide up there, Scott, that shows you dropping off the B-52 and me dropping off the White Knight. The X-15 at the bottom coming into land with a chase, and the Spaceship One coming into land with a chase. And we had Chuck Coleman in his extra 300 chasing me and calling out wheel height, and I don't know who you had chasing you. Chuck Yeager? I've heard of Chuck Yeager. Wow, you don't mess around with just ordinary guys. You go out and get some top billing boots to fly with you. That's great.
That wasn't wholly true, but it's good for this audience.
That's right. Okay, what I've got here is a comparison. I'm not able to see what's up on the screen very well, but if you look across, you can compare sizes and various things. My eyes don't work anymore, so I can't read them from here. But that is a correct, all of those are correct numbers for X-15 and for Spaceship One. So I'll leave that slide up for a little bit and we'll chat a little bit. Now I guess that, where's Steve at? Steve, where are you? You're supposed to be out here helping us. There he comes.
I'll give us some comparisons. The X-15 fuel load was the total weight of the White Knight and his launch vehicle.
Wow. So X-15's fuel load alone.
That are different.
Weighed the full gross weight of White Knight with the spaceship fully loaded, because we were about 20,000 pounds total gross weight.
We had almost 20,000 pounds of fuel and weighed out the airplane about 33.
That's pretty amazing.
And I won't put the B-52 weight in there. That would be cheating.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, now Steve's going to join us here and he's going to ask us some questions. And I think that's a good idea.
Steve, you want this? Join us.
Yeah, come and sit here. Move back a little so I can see Scotty.
I'm not sure I can sit between you guys.
Yeah, you can. Turn it on.
We're having great audio tonight, aren't we?
We are. You got to turn it on, Steve. That's part of the deal. How about this one? All right. Okay, right now I've got a slide up there that shows you the control system in the Spaceship One. It is basically push-pull tubes and cables. Wow, someone dropped something out there. And it's all mechanically controlled. There's no hydraulic controls. You can see the schematic there that shows it. It also shows a thing that looks like a turkey baster, and that is our liquid nitrous tank is the bulb. The rocket motor is behind that with the nozzle on it. The rocket motor was full of rubber, which is just the same thing as the tires on your car are made out of. And liquid nitrous is laughing gas. But if you light it, get the temperature up, it becomes a ferocious oxidizer, raises the temperature to a couple of thousand degrees and starts burning the rubber. And we get a peak thrust of about 18,000 pounds on a 6,000-pound vehicle. So when it lights off, you instantly have 3 Gs, eyeballs in. Then you have to make like a 2.5 feet. Whoa! That was cool. Honestly, I wasn't lying. And then we have to make about a 2.5-3G pull to make the turn. We cannot afford to accelerate in level flight because we would get too hot. So we make a turn and start going into thinner and thinner atmosphere as we accelerate to about 3.3 Mach as we go up, about 1,800, 1,900 knots. So Scotty's one. Let me show you a picture of his airplane. That's kind of a cutaway of what he had. And his was, yours are all hydraulic controls, right? Hydraulic control system?
Hydraulic irreversible controls. Better than this microphone. but primarily, you know, they were hugely powerful for damping, aerodynamic damping against flutter.
Yeah, so his controls were irreversible. Our controls were fully reversible. So we had to worry a little bit about flutter. We didn't go as fast as you guys went, but we were still concerned about flutter. Flutter
was stronger. You had stronger arms, though, I guess.
Yeah, flutter. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you had to be very strong to fly Spaceship One. When it went supersonic, no matter, I thought I was pretty strong. But I grabbed a hold of that stick, and I pulled as hard as I could, and nothing happened. So I had to revert to the trim system, which is what Bert had predicted we would have to do. But I thought maybe he was wrong for once. But he was dead right. You had to... We had to drive the control surfaces with powerful electric motors, and we primarily used pitch trim, which moved the entire stab and elevon as one unit together for pitch and asymmetrically for roll. And we used very little roll control. What we used was yaw control for roll, because Bert designed it so it had a lot of dihedral effect, and if you slip an airplane with dihedral effect, it'll couple to roll. So we used the rudder, or the yaw control, to roll the airplane while we were climbing, which is an odd thing to do, but, you know, Bert can be odd sometimes, and that's that's what he intended, I think, just try to fool us there, you know. The first time I played with the roll, I ended up with some bad things happened. So we used the yaw to roll, which is the way you fly a Spaceship One. You use pitch and yaw. That's how you fly it. You probably used all three axes, right?
I'm a Navy pilot, and I'm a rudder pilot.
Outstanding. That's great. Okay, so you got any questions here, Steve?
Well, we have a number of questions that were submitted by folks in the audience and also on the Internet, the folks who couldn't be here but had questions that they wanted to ask. So the first one is from Bob Miracle of Philadelphia, and he says, "Thank you, Bert Rutan and the whole team. You're real heroes to all of us." But he'd like to know from both of you, and you guys decide who goes first, but please describe what it was like to look back at the Earth from space.
Somebody's raining on your parade, and you can't hear you.
It is. It's raining on our parade. Well, for me, when I got up to about 64 miles or so up in the air, low, outside the Earth, looking back at the Earth was really... a moving experience, it really was. The colors, the texture, the blue of the Pacific, the browns and greens of the high desert was just the most enthralling thing I've ever seen. And to be able to see the curvature of the Earth, and you can see the thin blue line that is the atmosphere from up there, and you realize what a delicate thing that is and how thin it is. It's a very, very thin membrane. And it came to me very strongly that we need to protect that thing as much as we can. And the view was absolutely breathtaking. It really was. I loved every second of it.
Scott, what was your reaction to seeing the Earth looking back from space?
Well, I'm just a rookie at this. I never got over 100,000 feet. But I could see Baja, California, and New York at the same time, the curvature of the Earth, and stars at noon if you stopped to look. However, it was a little different world. I didn't have time to do all that sightseeing. I was working.
That's great. Yeah. Well, I feel like a shyster here, because I did have some time when we were at ZOG for about 4 minutes. I just stopped doing the flying the airplane, I grabbed my camera and took some pictures and threw up my M&Ms and did some things. I had a ball looking out of the window, rolled the airplane over and took a look at the ground, rolled it back up and looked at the black sky, and it was the most exciting, most thrilling thing I've ever done.
Our next question is, who is the best pilot you ever saw, Mike?
Who is the best pilot I ever saw? Apart from me.
Yeah.
I tell you what, I think the best pilot I've ever flown with is Chuck Coleman. He flies the extra that we used to do all of our high G wind up turns. And I don't know that I've seen a smoother stick than Chuck. And I learned a hell of a lot from him. He's a great guy sitting right there.
Scott, we'll ask you the same question now. Besides you, who's the best pilot you ever flew with?
I'll tell you, Steve, I've made it a practice all my life to not judge other pilots. I'm the only one I'm interested in.
Fair enough. Dave, here's one for you. What did you think of Mike being able to go into space wearing a flight suit and a helmet compared to the big heavy flight suit that you had to wear when you made your flights?
To use the vernacular, that's cool. I had one plus of suits. And,
they're a pain in them.
They're a pain. Yeah, I went to Beale and went through the pressure suit training. Went in the chamber, they blasted me up to 75,000 feet in about 1 second. And that was a very intimidating thing. But the thing was, it was pretty constricting, almost claustrophobic. When they closed that visor, I almost lost it.
Burtwood Tan is a smart guy, and he says, why fool around with this homo-form cabin? He just made a double-hole cabin, and his pressure suit was the inner hull. I think that's brilliant. Why didn't I think of that?
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, we felt very safe in our cabin. We pressure tested it to 34 psi and ran it at about 13 psi. So we had a lot of safety there. We had a lot of redundancy. And I never ever once felt insecure in there, even though I was just wearing a flight suit. And I could have flown in this set of clothes. It wouldn't have made any difference.
All right, why is the paint missing on the front of Spaceship One?
The paint?
Yes.
The orange stuff?
Yeah.
Okay, that's not paint.
Uh-huh.
That's an insulator that we developed at scale. That's a thermal protection that simply is an insulator, not an ablative material. And the reason we don't get the structure very hot is because we spend very little time at high temperature. Now, the X-15 spent a lot of time at very high temperature, just as the shuttle does, and we spent only a minute or two at very high temperatures, and there was not enough time for all that heat to conduct itself into our structure. If there had been, we wouldn't be here today. And they figured that out.
Well, now that we're talking a little bit about re-entry and the heat, things like that, can you describe for folks exactly how the revolution that Bert came up with for re-entry made Spaceship One possible?
Yeah. The thing that Bert calls the shuttlecock or the feather is we fold the tail up about 70 degrees from the horizontal, and that includes the aft half of the wing, or third of the wing, and that guides us back, much like a dart. If you drop a dart by the point, it'll turn around and go head first, and that's what happens to us. If we re-enter upside down, the feather turns us around and forces us to re-enter the right way up. But we strike the atmosphere, the fuselage essentially level, so the whole bottom of the fuselage and bottom of the wing presents an enormous amount of drag in the atmosphere, and we slow down very high, very quickly, so we don't get to very high temperatures. We get the air temperature around the vehicle gets 1,100 degrees or so, but the structure never ever goes close to that. There's not enough time for that hot air to warm up the structure. We'll start to cool right away in a couple of minutes.
You know, I got a Mike bends an airplane in two and he's a hero. I bent one in two and I'm a bum.
Well, here's a question for both of you. It comes from Aviation Exploring Post number 731. Yeah, they're right over there. It's well known that a lot of the NASA astronauts and have pre-flight rituals before they went flying. Did you have anything you did before you went flying?
Yeah, I went to bathroom.
How about you, Mike?
Well, that is an important feature. You've got to go to the bathroom. But no, I didn't do too much. You know, our flight wasn't very long. It was a one-hour climb, and about 25, 30 minutes, we were done after that. So about an hour and a half, you're back in the barn.
The truth of the matter is we both said on our father when we got in the airplane.
What's your, aside from Spaceship One, what's your favorite airplane to fly?
My Long Easy is the most favorite airplane to fly.
Okay.
Well, I don't know. I've flown some really neat airplanes. I've been lucky enough to fly an F-18. I thought that was pretty cool. White Knight's a pretty cool airplane to fly, too. You saw, I was having a little fun out there today. Burt's Boomerang comes off the coast. That thing, I did the first flight on it and some of the envelope expansion on it. And that's a really exquisite handling airplane. Unbelievable airplane to fly. And I wish somebody would put it in production.
There we go. And Mr. Crossfield, what's your favorite airplane to fly?
My favorite airplane was usually the airplane I was flying at the time. But I did have a kind of a soft spot for that old Bentwing Corsair.
All right.
Oh, wow. Very cool.
John Rickles, age 16, would like to know, how'd you become so successful in life?
How did I become so successful in life? Have I been successful in life? I guess. You know, behind every good man, there's a very good woman. And that woman is Sally, my wife. she's stood by me through thick and thin. We've been married nearly 44 years. And today, for the first time, she got to fly in the White Knight. She got to see the kind of work that I do for a living. She hadn't seen that before. She'd never been in the airplane. So yeah, I think she had a very good idea of what it takes to do that kind of thing. And it's a very busy thing to fly. And it was really great having her along and having her enjoy it alongside me, because I tell her what's happened, but she kind of blows it off because it doesn't mean anything to her. Now, it means more, and I think she enjoys it. I've been very lucky in my life. You know, Bert took me under his wing back in 1978. He taught me pretty much all I know about engineering test flying. I didn't go to a test pilot school, a formal test pilot school. I went to the Bert Rutan test pilot school. Dick Rutan was an enormous help to me, getting me on my way. I've been lucky enough to fly about 135 airplanes over the last bunch of years. And I've done 10 first flights of Bert's new airplanes. And I've just built up a pretty good repertoire of experience. And I think Bert trusts me to bring back good data, so I got lucky and was able to be this successful. He's played a large part in that, though. He's been a great guy to work for.
Jeff Wagner would like to know, on Spaceship One, what was the one problem or system that you struggled the most to find a solution to? Something that you might have even thought that you wouldn't be able to solve. Is there something that sticks out in your mind?
It was this, I assume you were talking about during the flight test.
Yeah.
I think the hardest thing that Bert had to do was to come up with a way to re-enter safely. That was the toughest problem he faced. But we had some problems. We had the tail was a little bit too small. We got some separation on the tail, lost control of the airplane on one of the flights. I had a little rolling event on one of the flights. That was that was a bit exciting. And but we learned from those things, you know. We fixed the first problem, and when Brian flew his flight, we had figured out what caused the rolling action. And he was able to fly it in such a way that it never happened to him. We didn't have to fix the airplane. He just flew it more perfectly than I did. And so he didn't get the rolls, and he went higher than I did. And Brian's a hell of a pilot, and I've really been privileged to fly with Brian a lot. I love the guy.
All right. A lot of the questions we received centered around the rolling event that, that you had. So maybe you'd like to go into a little more depth on exactly what happened, what caused it, and how you came up with a solution.
So the vertical rolls that I saw at about, I guess it started about 160 or 170,000 feet. They ran like Mach 2.7. And I was very, very vertical, almost laying over on my back. And I trimmed the nose down to get it perfectly vertical. And when we took all the lift off the wing wasn't lifting at all. We had zero lift, zero angle of attack. I went to negative angle of attack slightly. And at that point, the airplane's directional stability is pretty weak, and I probably moved the control surface of one or another, a rudder or an aileron, and the airplane departed from controlled flight in a snap roll. That was about an 8-degree nose-up, instantaneous pitch-up, 15 degrees of yaw, and it snapped around with an initial roll rate of 283 degrees per second. So I put all the controls against that roll, not understanding what had caused it. While I was still in a little bit of atmosphere, I got the roll rate down to about 160 degrees per second. Then we went out of the atmosphere, and I engaged the, put the feather up, and engaged the reaction control system, and was able to, we had enough authority in our reaction controls to completely arrest all of those rolls. I wound up doing 29 vertical rolls between 160 and 300,000 feet. So there was, I'm going to claim a new record for that.
He's the first space aerobatic show pilot.
I think so.
The first space aerobatic show pilot. Oh, boy. Chuck is mad because he likes to think he can do a lot of rolls going vertical. So I think you were jealous, weren't you, Chuck? Got you there.
What instruments are used to measure Spaceship One's altitude and airspeed when you get up to the high altitudes, considering that the air is too thin to use a conventional instrument? And that came from Paul Steiger, by the way.
So we have conventional airspeed and altitude in there, just the normal round dials that you see in a Cessna. And, of course, when you get up that high, they don't work at all. But we have an inertial system that is corrected every second by GPS for position, and we derive out of that inertial system true airspeed or keys, equivalent airspeed, really. And our true speed at the top end was about 1,900 knots. So we're moving along at about 3,400 feet every second. Not as fast as an X-15, but still pretty fast for a little plastic airplane. Altitude comes out of the same source. And it's very accurate, extremely accurate. In fact, Edwards Air Force Base used a very accurate radar to track us. And so did China Lake track us. And I believe that China Lake, Edwards, and our machine were within like a couple of feet, 2 or 3 feet of each other. And that was accepted by the XPRIZE folks as being the real altitude. And I got up to 337,000 feet, about 64 miles. And Brian went to 367,000 feet, which is about 70 miles. So he ran the motor a little longer than I did. I had the responsibility to bring the airplane back all in one piece, so that we didn't have to do any work on the airplane to make the next flight. So I shut it down as soon as I knew I was going to make the altitude, and Brian left his running a lot longer because we didn't expect to have to do another flight. So he got lucky, and he actually took the unofficial record away from the X-15 folks. Joe Walker flew it to 354,000. Brian went to 367. So we did top X-15's highest altitude, but to be fair, the X-15 guys were not trying to go to altitude. They were trying to go really fast. We were trying to go to altitude. But it was a challenge. I know Bert was very excited that we were able to break that record. And I am impressed as hell. You know, we had about 25 guys out of scales, 120 guys or people that worked on this program and built White Knight, built Spaceship One, developed and tested on the ground a rocket motor from scratch, and we also designed and built and developed a flight simulator. So it was four different things that we did for about $25 million, which would buy you maybe a main tire on a shuttle, you know.
Which brings up this follow-up question. Is it encouraging or disheartening to see NASA and its massive budget lagging behind people like you?
I think it's inaccurate to say they're lagging behind us, honestly. I've got a lot of time for the guys who fly the shuttle. I think they must have extremely very, very brave people. And because I tell you, the shuttle is a damn dangerous vehicle. The spaceship one is not at all. It's a very safe vehicle. I'd be happy to take my wife and kids in it. But the shuttle is a hazardous thing to fly, and you've got to have big kahunas to fly that thing. And those guys have been working extremely hard to make it safer. And tomorrow, with any luck, they're going to go again. And that's great. I'm really, really proud of them, and I hope they do a good job and do a safe job. But you and I are never going to fly in that vehicle. We are never going to be invited to do that. And you will be invited to fly in our vehicle.
So when are we going flying? When are we going flying in the spaceship? When will any of us be able to take a flight?
Well, I think we'll be flying a prototype of the larger vehicle in probably 3 or 4 years. We've got to get it certified. Not only the spaceship 2, but the White Knight 2 will have to be certified by the FAA, and that's going to be a fairly long program. But I think that we'll be carrying passengers into space 5 to 7 years from now, and 10 years from now, half of you guys will have been to space probably. So it's going to happen. It's going to happen sooner than you think. We're working hard on the problem right now. And I think Bert's going to make some announcements this week that'll give you a better idea. I don't want to preempt him.
Excellent. Now that we've dubbed you the first aerobatic space pilot, when will you become the first space CFI?
I'm too old for that. I'm told now that I'm not allowed to fly. I won't be allowed to fly passengers into space because commercial pilots are not allowed to fly passengers if they're above 60 years of age. And I'm 64 going on 65, so I'm pretty well out of luck. I might get to fly some of the developmental test flights, but I'm certainly not going to ever carry any paying passengers.
But you did take some M&Ms.
Oh yeah, got to bring the M&Ms. I did that just so that everybody could see we really were at zero G, and I was real excited that I did that.
One of the questions was, have you eaten any of the M&Ms that were actually on board?
I haven't, but my wife Sally cleaned them out of the airplane because I spilled a whole bag of them in there, and she offered one to one of the firemen, thinking he would want to keep it as a souvenir, and he popped it in his mouth and ate it. No, there are guys out there offering lots of money for one of those M&Ms, and this guy just swallowed it.
You can always buy a lot of M&Ms, and nobody knows where they came.
But those M&Ms had been to space, and so they were really special. But he didn't care.
So, Mike, you told me a story about your hat that you're wearing tonight. It's sort of a special hat and has some interesting history behind it.
There is. I bought this hat in 1996 at Oshkosh, and bought one for Dick as well. And Dick Rutan and I flew our long easies all the way around the world in 1997, and we wore these hats. And this one is rotten on the inside. I had to put new Velcro on the back because the plastic all perished. But this is the very hat that I wore around the world in my long easy in 1997. And these are the same tennis shoes, too, so it's kind of a special deal for me.
Aviation isn't a high-paying business.
Yeah, you don't get paid enough to buy new tennis shoes, you know. You got to keep them a long time.
Maybe we can make a deal. We can take you over to one of the souvenir shops here and get you a new hat.
That'd be good.
Mr. Crossfield, you worked with the Wright Experience doing the Wright Flyer, that recreation, and your experience with really going backwards in time to recreate something that had already been done. How do you compare that experience and working through those problems and then watching what happened with Spaceship One? You've kind of been involved in both ends of the spectrum there.
There is no comparison. The Wright Flyer is not flyable.
I tell you, Scotty, I was scared when I saw you fall out of that thing. When you hit the ground pretty hard and went rolling across the ground like a bowling ball, and I thought, wow, Scotty shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't be doing that, Scotty.
It's the only airplane in the world that you don't want any more power than terminal velocity at stall speed, or it goes unstable on you.
Wow.
It's the only airplane in the world that takes a woman with good hips to make the ailerons work on it.
So you didn't have the right hip sway to be able to do the ailerons, huh?
It's the only airplane in the world that you want a short runway on so that you're forced to get in the air before you get more than above stall on the right side of the power curve.
Right.
It is not a flyable airplane, and it only flew 5 times in 100 years. We did it, I mean 6 times. We did it twice, they did it 4 times.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. I know, I saw a video of this, and it took a heck of a pilot to fly that thing any distance at all.
It took 2 years to teach them to do it. The Wright brothers did it because they knew something. They didn't know it. They just didn't have a powerful enough engine to get into this. My engine people were bragging about adding a couple of horsepower. I kept telling them we don't want it, but you can't convince anybody in aviation you don't want more horsepower.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. Wow. You have to take your hat off to the Wright brothers. Those guys had some serious kahunas.
And as we're going back in time, we'll ask both of you this. What influenced you to get into aviation in the first place?
Aviation.
Scotty's very succinct. You know that about that.
Well, how about you?
It was part of my job. I was out on the road working in a company I worked for, servicing the equipment. And I told my brothers-in-law who owned the company that we needed somebody to be able to learn how to fly so they could go these places quicker and get the servicing done. So they paid for my pilot's license. So that was a good deal.
Excellent. Well, as the rain continues to come down, we're just about out of questions. So what is it that you'd like to add that we haven't talked about tonight about your whole experience here, arriving in Oshkosh, the flight across the country?
Well, it was the first time the Wright Knight had ever flown away from Mojave. It has, the furthest it ever went east was about Barstow, which is not very far away from Mojave. And when we took off a couple of days ago and headed to Albuquerque, it had never been that far away. And our display peaked out. It's only designed to work within the Edwards, Mojave area. So it didn't know where the heck it was. The moving map became a black screen with a little airplane in the middle. And it said, warning. You are outside the glide cone.
Oh, that brother knew the ball in their speech.
So that was kind of funny. And we had that warning on the screen all the way to here. It was a bit of a pain. But we stopped in Albuquerque. We got a quick turn at Cutters there. The guys were great. Then we went to Tulsa International Airport. And a man by the name of Roger had us to put us up in the most magnificent hangar I've ever seen in my life, and treated us like royalty, put our airplanes in the hangar, locked them up, kept them safe, and bought us a tank of gas. So, you know, EAA is paying part of the fee to get us here, so we saved you some money, guys. We got one guy to buy our fuel for us, and that was a savings there of a couple, $4,000 or so. So that was a great place to stop. But when we got out of the cabin, I mean, it was like 110, and I don't know what the humidity was, but I've never been that hot in my whole life. And it was pretty warm here when we landed, but cool by comparison to Oklahoma. But we did have good weather on the whole trip, including today. We got very lucky. We never ran into any bad weather anywhere, and we could have run into something like this, and that would have really messed us up. So I think we were lucky to get here. It was very, very delightful to fly from Madison. We spent the night in Madison, Wisconsin last night, so that we could come up here and arrive at exactly the right time. Tommy wanted us here at 3 o'clock. And we couldn't do that coming from Mojave. There's no way to get here by 3 o'clock because we don't have lights, and we'd have to have taken off at 3 in the morning. So we came to Madison, and then we were met by Jim Kepnick and Bruce Moore flying the photo plane for EAA, and we spent about an hour with them flying up here and taking lots of video and lots of pictures, so you're going to see some really spectacular pictures as this thing develops, because Jim, I know, takes some of the best pictures in the world, and he took pictures of us with EAA's grounds in the background, so that should look great. And then we broke away and made a couple of passes and landed downwind and got chastised. I honestly didn't know the wind was going the other way. I think I'm going to talk to the air boss about that. He didn't tell me that. Anyway, it was okay. We overran the turnoff a little bit. I didn't want to burn up the brakes, so I didn't get too fierce on the brakes, and I was very happy to make a reasonable landing.
What is next for White Knight and Spaceship One?
Well, White Knight is busy right now doing captive carry and finally some launching on the X-37, an ex-Boeing program that's being run by DARPA. And we've got 2 captive carry flights with that vehicle. And when we get back, it'll go right back to that job, and it'll be doing some more. I think there's 1 more captive carry and then 3 drops, or 1 drop, depending on how well it works. And it's an autonomous airplane, doesn't have any pilot in it, so, you know, all bets are off when you let it go. But the White Knight is going to carry Spaceship One to Dulles in Washington, D.C. We're going to drop it off there. It's going to be put on a truck and taken to the downtown National Air and Space Museum. It's going to hang up in the ceiling between the Bell X-1, Chuck Yeager's supersonic airplane, and Charles Lindbergh's Spirit of St. Louis. It'll be hanging right between them, slightly low. And right across the hole is the X-15 pointed straight at us. So, you know, we're in some really, really good company there. And I am extremely proud to have been a part of a program that winds up in the finest museum in the world. And it'll stay there forever and be maintained in its present condition. And I think that's a fabulous thing.
Mike, I have 4 airplanes in the house in which you behave.
Wow. I told you, you're my hero, Chuck. Yeah. Of course, just across the way is the Voyager. Bird return design. Dick and Gina flew it around the world. It hangs in pretty much the same room. It's slightly down underneath the mezzanine. But we'll be hanging in the front entrance in the Milestones Hall of Milestone Flights, I guess. And you can't do any better than that. There's no way to improve on. There's no better place to put that airplane anywhere on the planet. And all of us at Scaled are very proud of that.
And rightfully, you should be proud of that. It's quite an accomplishment.
If we fast forward another 20 years, are we going to see a Hondo kit that will be a rocket plane?
I don't know. You'd have to ask Bert. I don't know if he's out there, but I bet he is. I don't know. You know, that would be fabulous, but it's a lot to take on, believe me. It seems simple. The airplane is pretty simple, but it costs a lot of money to do something like that in the terms that we know about. You know, $20, $25 million is a lot of money in anybody's book. And we are very, very lucky and fortunate to have had Paul Allen be generous enough to give us that much money. I mean, that guy took a heck of a chance. You know, he just said, well, these guys seem to know what they're doing. He did a little research and he came down and gave us the money and said, here's the money, go do it. And we couldn't have had a better circumstance. You know, we've never had a better customer. Most customers want you to track every little dime and every little dollar, and Paul was just interested in getting up into space. And I take my hat off to him. I admire him dramatically for what he did.
Any final thoughts this evening?
Final thoughts for the evening. Well, it's great to have an audience like you guys. There is no better audience in the world than you guys. And Scott and I feel very lucky to be talking to an audience like you guys. Yeah. Well, you know, when you're in a government program that's government funded, it's not a black program, I guess, at the time, but you can't be having your wife run out to meet you at the airplane, that's for sure. They're going to stop her coming across the fence. So I was very lucky. Scotty did get gypped, because he's got a wonderful wife.
I'm going to close my part here. Mike and I are very similar. The fine people we can associate with, the good airplanes we could fly, and the fine women we married, we're the richest men in the world, even though we never made a nickel.
I couldn't agree more, Scott. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Scott.
Ladies and gentlemen, two of aviation's heroes, Mike Melville, Scott Crossfield, here at AirVenture Oshkosh. Thank you very much for being with us at Theater in the Woods this evening. I tell you to stay dry on your way home, but I don't think that's going to happen. So make the best of it. Mike and Scott tell me that the weather tomorrow is supposed to be sunny and 73. So if it's not that way, you know who to blame. But thank you again for joining us this evening in this wonderful weather, and hope you have a great AirVenture. We'll see you back here tomorrow on the flight line and tomorrow night at Theater in the Woods. Got another great lineup for you. Thank you. Have a great evening.
Test pilot Scott Crossfield and commercial astronaut Mike Melville speaking at the Theater in the Woods during AirVenture 2005. And that's our program for Thursday, July 28th, 2005. All this week, ANN is experimenting with podcasting, trying to find a format that works for us, and more importantly, works for you. Please let me know what you think. My email is editor@aero-news.net. I'm Aero News Senior Editor Pete Combs. Thanks for listening. We'll see you at the airport.